Let's get started. It's 9:31. Boker Tov, everybody. We'll start back for Kevot. Nice to see everybody. Those I see when the camera's on. Okay, so we're at Perek Beit Mishnah Vav, at least in my edition. It could maybe Mishnah Zayin in yours. We're in the middle of Hillel discussing a series of statements. Last week we learned you can't be shy. That's a very, very, you can't be shy. A teacher can't be too strict. Has to, you know, let things slide up a little bit. You have to have thick skin. And not everybody in business becomes smart. Some people in business become smart. The way the wording we discussed last week, and take a leadership role. That was part of what we discussed last week. Okay, so Hillel continues, and we have again, for the second time, a Mishnah in Aramaic, and both times said by Hillel. We discussed the Mishnah, of course, is written in Hebrew. We discussed this when we came upon it in the first chapter, the Mishnah being in Aramaic. Mishnah was written in Hebrew. Hebrew is the spoken language of the Jewish people, or the official language. And I mentioned at the time that even the Talmud, the Gemara itself, most of the statements of the rabbis were about 85 to 90%. That's what I'm told. I haven't researched that on my own, but if you look Gemara, you'll see it. You pay attention. The statements of the rabbi, like Rava says, or Abaye says something, or Rav Yochanan, 90% of the time it's in Hebrew. The discussion, the back and forth, is in English. It makes a lot of sense. It's like you go to school, you're learning Chumash, so the text you learn is going to be in Hebrew. But the discussion, in, at least in America, in North America, is going to be in English. So that's sort of what the Gemara is. The official statement, even of the rabbis, is, you know, Amar Rava Chayav Adam Lirot Adatzmo, whatever, you know, Kilu Hu Yatzam Mitzrayim, right? Any statement is going to be pretty much in Hebrew, the discussion in Aramaic. Of course, the Gemara discussion in Aramaic, because that's what people spoke. The Mishnah was written in Israel, even though Aramaic was the spoken language in Israel. It's still written in Hebrew. We have a few, very few exceptions. And Hillel, of course, is one of the exceptions. He usually speaks in Hebrew. But here he's speaking in Aramaic, because Hillel came from, you know, Babel, what God had appointed. He sort of came out of nowhere. He went onto the roof, the famous story. He didn't have any money, and he went on the roof. And they know, because they had guards, you know. He couldn't pay tuition. That's really what it was. There was a guard to collect tuition at the gate, and he didn't have any money, and they didn't let him in, and he went to the roof, and then they discovered him. It was snowing. Again, I don't know that the story is literal necessarily. And then, of course, Hillel becomes, he answered a halachic question about bringing the Korban Pesach on Shabbat. Nobody knew the answer, and he had a tradition from his teachers, you can bring the Paschal sacrifice even on Shabbat, even though it's sort of a personal sacrifice. You're not allowed to bring a personal sacrifice on Shabbat. He got appointed the Nasi. So he spoke Aramaic coming from Babel. But I'm assuming the reason this is in Aramaic is sort of, it's a folk statement, like a saying, you know, you quote those in the original language. Anyway, what does he say? He once saw a skull that was on the surface of the water, a marla. So he's Amarla. He said to the skull, like, it's funny, Amarla. Amar means he would say. In other words, he was talking to the skull. He's talking, Al da at teikt atfuch besof mitifach yitufun. So this is a very powerful theological statement. Because you killed somebody, you put somebody in the sea, you threw somebody overboard, that's why you were thrown overboard. And you know what? The person who threw you overboard, the person who drowned you, will himself meet the same fate. In other words, midah keneged midah. Yeah, I know you're that measure for measure. That God, nothing happens in this world by chance. And if you do something wrong, you're going to pay the price, often in the same area. And the person who does see, in other words, the even though the Jewish people had to suffer in Egypt, that's the question. If God promoted they're going to be in Egypt, why do the Egyptian people have to suffer? When you cause others to suffer, you will suffer. Now, I'll discuss that hopefully in a minute, but basically I hope you picked up by now. One of my favorite themes is pointing out contradictions and not resolving them. In other words, in a sense, they're not meant to be resolved necessarily. They indicate differing aspects. Really, that's what every machloket is. Right, the revolution of Rav Chaim Brisker, we've spoken about him in other contexts, but his learning revolution, in a sense, was pretty much until his time, until the time of Rav Chaim, you know, he had an argument between the Rambam and the Ravid. So this one would bring proof. I'll bring you 12 proofs the Rambam is right, and he'll bring 15 proofs the Ravid is right. This source indicates that. It's an argument who's right and who's wrong. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik changed that. Maybe I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but Rav Chaim Soloveitchik changed that fundamentally. He said the Rambam and Ravid are both right. They just have two different ways of looking at the same things. Life is gray. So it's not that the Rambam is right or the Ravid is wrong, right? Each one looks at something in a particular way. So therefore, they come to a different conclusion. So that's a machloket in general. Here we have a serious issue, because on the one hand, the Mishnah Hillel claims that there is basically justice in the world. You harm people, you will get harmed. And the person who harms you, who's in a sense carrying out the divine will, after all, you did something wrong. So what did he do wrong? He too will suffer the same fate. You have to suffer. It doesn't have to be through the other person. But of course, on the other hand, we know the serious problem of tzaddik v'ralo, rasha v'tovlo. We know that's not true. The righteous often suffer and the wicked often prosper. This, according to the Talmud, this question dates back to Moshe Rabbeinu. We date it to Eov very often. This is the book of Eov. Why do the righteous have to suffer? But it's already, the Talmud in Brachot already raises that question that Moshe on Mount Sinai asked God. And of course, that's panai lo yirah. You can't understand God. And life is not always fair. And I think basically, how do you resolve the contradiction? You don't resolve the contradiction. They're both true. Sometimes life isn't fair, and sometimes you see midah k'neged midah, and sometimes you see measure for measure. People are punished exactly for what they did, and we all see it in our own life. So I think Hillel is expressing the theological notion that everything that happens is for a cause. Now, even we're coming up to, actually this week is the 3 weeks already. The rabbis famously say, I think it's today's Daf Yomi or tomorrow's Daf Yomi. I know Kuf Yud Tet is the Gemara gives about 7 reasons for the destruction of the temple, right? And whenever you have 10 reasons for something, you know what that means? That means we have no idea what the reason is, right? That's a klal gadol. That's how Nechama Leibowitz made famous in her commentary on Rashi. If you have 2 explanations in Rashi, it means neither of them are fully correct. Rashi would not bring a second explanation if the first one, you know, satisfied him. So the second one has a problem. Each explanation has a problem that the other one solves, and together they solve the verse. That was one of Nechama Leibowitz's sort of things that she drilled into people, that makashel the Rashi, you may have heard that expression, what's bothering Rashi? And if you can answer with one question, with one sentence, don't answer with two. Brevity, answer it right. So whenever the rabbis give this reason, it means they don't know the reason, or it's a combination of reasons. But of course, the rabbis weren't given reasons for the destruction of the temple anyways. That's I mentioned once. It's the Romans were a much more powerful army. Their political, geopolitical reasons the temple were destroyed. What the rabbis always say is whenever there's a disaster, we should look inwards. What are we doing wrong? I think it's a very important point. Perhaps it's a subtle point. I don't think the rabbis ever meant to say that we lost the temple because of Sinat Chinam. That's the most famous reason. I mean, it is true that when a society is torn inside, they're easier to capture. So there is, if we're not united. But the rabbis are saying, in other words, what was the sin that we have to look at ourselves to improve because of what happened? And therefore, you can have 10 different reasons, every rabbi looking at a particular sin. Anyway, but here, here you have this, this fundamental, chasm. On the one hand, life is not fair. The righteous have to suffer. And on the other hand, life sometimes is very, very fair. And we have to learn a lesson. Hillel is teaching us not necessarily a factual statement that it's always true, but he's telling us when something bad happens. That's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says you should always look inwards. We can't look to other people. It's not for me to say that you suffer. That's the problem. I say you suffer because of this. That's a terrible thing. That's considered ona'ah. In other words, even telling Eov, the Gemara says, even for the people to, what did you do wrong? You're not allowed to say things like that. You can only say it about yourself. Whether a rabbinic figure, can say for a community, that's a slightly different question. I'm not talking about an individual, right? But individually, you can't say. And I guess community leaders have the responsibility to discuss what are they feel the areas the community needs. Like, we've discussed many times, everybody knows. There's a lot to learn from COVID. One thing that I'm like, the main things we have to learn, how to treat the elderly, of course. We've been very lax. Everybody who is in Canada knows that we lead the world, and 80% of deaths have been nursing homes, long-term care facilities. Although that's in of itself not necessarily a terrible thing. It could be because everybody else is doing really well. We socially distance, but of course it has a lot of those deaths were unnecessary because of CARES. That's one thing we have to learn for sure. How to treat people, our priorities in life, you know, slowing down, that's for sure clear. But the one thing that people have heard me often before the lectures, you know, when I talk to people, it still astounds me. I don't know what happened to Pikuach Nefesh. It's like unbelievable how the people leading the charge to open up shuls and churches even, but okay, that's not our issue. You know, rabbis who should know better are the ones who want to put our life more at risk, whatever. I don't get it. Like I've said many, many times, you know, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik would tell it. We spoke about this last week, would tell people not to fast. He was very strict on Pikuach Nefesh. I'm astounded by some of the lack of, if I can say so, maybe it's not right for me to say, but I think the lack of a coordinated rabbinic voice. There are some, but not enough. Too many rabbis are pushing too hard to open. There is a pushback, thank God. Anyways, enough of that. But the idea is that when there's a tragedy, it would be a terrible thing to say that COVID is happening because of this sin or that sin. That's awful. That's terrible. But to say because of COVID, what, even if you want to phrase it to yourself, what sin am I doing that I should improve? That's a wonderful thing. So that's always the fine line we have to watch ourselves. So Hillel here is expressing the view that life is, there's a rhyme and reason to everything. Everything that happens, a skull floating in the ocean is not just a skull floating in the ocean. It tells a life story about somebody who did something wrong, and what you do will be impacted later, and how you treat people, etc. Okay, Huya Omer. Let's move on to the next Mishnah. Hillel would say, well, all these Mishnah are pretty well known. Marbe basar marbe rima. Okay, we'll read the five things and then we'll try to explain it a little bit. One who has a lot of meat, marbe basar, has a lot of worms, marbe rima. Marbe basar probably is talking about the person. It's not talking about buying meat in the butcher shop. It's talking about the person, the more heavy you are. The more basar you have, the more worms are going to eat you in the grave. Marbe nechasim, this is a really tough one. We'll discuss, come back to this. Marbe daga, the more money, the more worries. Nechasim are not only property. The more property, the more worries. Marbe nashim, the more women, I just don't shoot the messenger. Marbe keshafim, you'll have greater witchcraft. Kishuf, which was in the Torah, you have a lot against that. Today, we don't relate to that. Marbe shvachot, a lot of maidservants. Marbe zima, a lot of licentiousness and immorality. Marbe avadim, here a shivcha meaning a female servant, and an eved meaning a male servant. Marbe gazel, then you'll have a lot of thievery. So, of course, to say this is, I guess, a little bit of a politically incorrect Mishnah. You have lots of things like that. But doesn't mean it isn't true. It just means people need to be comfortable. But what exactly is going on here? And again, it's not a blanket statement, but everything. So again, I'll quote what the Tiferet Yisrael says, one idea. He says like this. He says, basically, people going through life have five desires they want, and they basically go in order as you age in life. You can probably tell me what they are, but number one is physical needs, food, baby. You know, everybody, a baby cries in the middle of the night means either they need their diaper changed or they're hungry. So they want to eat. That's our basic need. Number two, we like money. Everybody likes money. Everybody wants money. That's normal. Number three is the sexual drive, the lust for a woman. Always, our texts are always written and from a male perspective, just the way it is. And then, in other words, you know, where you read the Torah, generally the Gemara, there were very few females. I mean, there are some, of course, Bruria and Yalta, there are many exceptions, of course. But as a rule, the women were not involved in the rabbinic discussions, and it's written from a male perspective. But it applies both ways. And there's Acer Connecto. So of course, Acer Connecto is written that that Eve is an Acer Connecto for Adam, but Adam's also an Acer Connecto for Eve. It's not, it works both ways. Of course, in the immediate verse in the Torah, it's working one way, but obviously the concept that the spouses help each other, obviously is not just a wife to a husband. That's it's just the way when the Torah was written, it was written from that perspective. Anyway, the lust, of course, works both ways too. Number four, kavod, right? We know that people, as you get a little bit older, the money isn't as important and your urges sort of die down a little bit. But people like honor, they get a little bit older. And then older people, they want to just make sure that things are taken care of, their affairs are taken care of, be passed on to the next generation properly. So he goes through in this order. Overeating, marbe basar. In other words, the first thing you want, food. If you eat too much food, you're going to end up, too many, the ants are going to eat you up. Oh, he also, of course, points out that it's not just when you die, when you live. We know obesity, and we know all the problems of eating, how important food is. You know, the Rambam, who was, of course, the greatest doctor of his time, in the Mishnah Torah, has an entire chapter on nutrition in halacha. It's not like some side thing. It's, in other words, in his halachic code, it's in, I believe, Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah. I think it's Perek Daled in Yisodei HaTorah. I have to double check. Yisodei HaTorah mean the fundamentals of Torah. I think that's where it is. Maybe, actually, it might be in Hilchot Deyot, which is right after that. In other words, how we're supposed to live our life. That's where the Rambam writes on the golden mean. So the Rambam has a whole chapter, what to eat, nutrition. It's not just a nice thing to do, but it's he codifies it. Whether everything he says today is still 100% valid, that's, you have to ask the doctors. But much of it is. And the true matter is the Rambam would be the first one to say that if it's not, you shouldn't follow what he says. The Rambam is the one who says we're not allowed to follow the medicines of the Talmud. The Talmud discusses illness and the cure, and the Rambam says we can't follow those. If a doctor today practices medicine from 1,000 years ago, you sue him for malpractice and take his license away. So that's what the Rambam says. You can't use Talmudic medicine in the Middle Ages, and you can't use medieval medicine in the modern time. You can't even use medicine from 5 years ago today. I mean, it's impossible to keep up. That's why we have all the specialists who can keep up. So you subspecialize. You spend 4 years medical school, 4 years of residency and 4 years of fellowship, and then about this amount, this amount of medicine, you know everything. But okay, that's the way the world works. We all work together, so we can work it anyway. So the number one thing we like to eat, don't eat too much. Number two, we like money, marbe nechasim, marbe daga. So this we all know. It's I don't know what to, there's nothing I can add. We'll come to the fourth Berak, which is Ezu Ashir Samech V'Chalcho. I always like to quote my father. It's a beautiful idea that Samech V'Chalcho, we normally translate who's rich, who's happy with what you have. So we've often explained, I've often explained this to my students in chat. We're talking about chat before. It's not a moral idea. That's an economic argument. In other words, we hasamech v'chalko, that's a nice thing, the rabbi in shul says who's rich if you're happy with it. Yeah, but on Bay Street, on Wall Street, you're rich if you make a $5 million bonus, whatever. What do you mean? It's not economics, but it is economics, because money is worthless. Money's a piece of paper, has absolutely no value. There's value because the government says it has value. The government declares it's legal tender. If the government would declare it's not legal tender, it'd be worthless overnight. That's what happened in World War II. Money became worthless. So what's money? Money is meaningless. Money is the ability to buy things. Money is the ability to get what you need. So if you have what you need, you have all the money in the world. It's an economic argument. Oh. The rabbis were talking economics. Ezu Ashir, Hasamech Mechalko, one is wealthy, means if I have all my everything I need, then I have all the money in the world I need. Because what's money in the bank? It's not even a piece of paper anymore. It's a line on a, you go online and you look and you see a number. So the rabbi says, Samech V'chalko is an economic response. It's not just a moral response. But my father always used to say, Samech V'chalko, in sort of Hebrew, my portion is, of course, they have to say this, Chalki. Chalko means you're happy with somebody else has. So the wealthy person is the person who, when somebody else is wealthy, he's still happy. When somebody has more than him, because we all know our wealth is relative, right? That's how people, human nature is. We define our wealth, not how much money we have, how much money we have in comparison to what the other person has. People used to be happier two generations ago living in much smaller homes than people. You know, it's whatever. Our lusts have grown. Money. It's a sameach b'chalko. That's really hard. The really, really wealthy person is somebody who can be happy with somebody else's money. And that's hard. But okay, we have to work on that. You want a lot of money. Money's great, and we need it, and of course, and we're not against. We pray every day. We should be wealthy. We should just use the wealth well. That's all. Be happy with what we have. Well, wealth is good. Wealth is a wonderful thing used properly, but it can be a terrible thing, like anything. If it can be good, it can be bad, right? Newton's third law of motion, right? The spiritual, right? Everything that's applicable in the physical world is applicable in the spiritual world. That's a basic Jewish belief. The physical and the spiritual world were joined together. Sometimes they're in conflict with each other, but the same idea. So just like in the physical world, for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. The stronger the action, the stronger the reaction. So in the spiritual world, the more powerful something is, the more dangerous it is. The more it can do good, the more it can do bad. Torah can do so much good in this world, but Torah can do so much bad. Misuse Torah, misuse religion is terrible. Chilul Hashem, right? Nuclear energy, phenomenal, phenomenal. Destroy the world, right? Rice Krispies or cornflakes is irrelevant. So it can't do much good, can't do much bad. Like, who cares, right? So money is very powerful. So money can do tremendous good, but it can ruin your life. And I'm sure everybody here knows people where both of those are true. The more money you have, the more worries you have. That's true. I'll just tell a cute story. I remember many years ago, I guess this was right after the first Gulf War. So Barra Wine spoke in Toronto. I'm sure many of you know Barra Wine, a very distinguished rabbi, ran at the OU for many years, was a lawyer first for 9 years, then went into the rabbinate. It was in Miami, and a very colorful personality, also wonderful, you know, speaker. So Barra Wine said that he was flying on an airplane soon after the Gulf War. I remember him telling the story correctly. I heard it when he was in Toronto, and he said the guy next to him was reading the paper, and you know, every 30 seconds going, oi, oi, you know, crutching, going terrible, and sort of what's going on. So he says he's looking at the stock market, and the market was crashing, and he's losing, you know, he's calculating how many hundreds of thousands of dollars he's losing in the stock market. So he's very upsetting. So Barra Wine said, Baruch Hashem, I didn't lose any money in the stock market. So, you know, it's all perspective. Of course, it's half a joke because everybody loses when it goes down. But you get the idea. You don't have money in the stock market, you don't worry so much every day how the Dow Jones is doing. So we know this. I'm not saying anything you don't know. Marbe Nechasim, Marbe Daga. You have a lot of worries, and sometimes it's not good. Sometimes it's not good. I have a friend once, I remember, a good friend of mine told me he didn't want to marry a wealthy girl.
Side mayor, the two bags of fruit.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mute everybody, and I can always mute everybody at the moment. So if you want, just mute yourself or I'll have to, okay, please. I'm sorry. Otherwise, I'll have to mute everybody. And
just give me one second.
Okay. Okay, so for some, he said, you know, there's certain things. Money can be very dangerous. Marben Nashim, Marbek Shafim. The next thing we said, move on. The lust, the sex drive is also the same thing. Very powerful. It can be used for very good or very negative things. So that's what the Mishnah says. Marbek Shafim. You have too many women. Of course, we're dealing in the time of the Mishnah where somebody was allowed, at least a man was allowed to marry more than one woman. We did away with that, of course. Also sounds very, the Torah never liked the idea. How do I know the Torah never liked the idea of polygamy? The Torah, there are lots of things in the Torah it didn't like, but it allowed. How do I know the Torah didn't like polygamy? If anybody wants to speak up, I think you can speak. You don't have to, but look at all the cases in the Torah when somebody married more than one wife, Sarah. Abraham and the problems with Sarah and Keturah and Yishmael and throwing out of the house. And obviously Yaakov and Leah and Rachel was a disaster. I think I mentioned it's clear. The Torah didn't like it. Eshet Yifat Toar, you have a lot of things in Torah. This, again, the Rambam would be the one who explains it the best. People, you know, the idea that the Torah was given in a particular historical time period And the Torah couldn't uproot everything. The Torah was a revolutionary document. I always like to say the Torah is the editorial page of the newspaper. The Torah is not interested in what's going on. The Torah is commenting on what's going on in the world. They expect you to know. The Torah doesn't write. Torah doesn't care about the history, but it has to comment on the history. So that's why, I mean, you know, there are people who, if you understand the Torah and it's Near Eastern, you know, context, you know, there are a lot of things become very clear. Marty Lechner was talking about this on Tuesday on Lok Devash Yogdi, Bachalevi Mo. That was a practice of idolaters when they went to the temple, and that's exactly what the Torah says. When you go to the temple, because it's the same parsha as Bikurim, the same pasuk is bring your first fruits to the temple, you don't cook your kid in its mother's milk. And it's a very historical argument. It's troubling for people. You can listen to Marty Lechner's lection we just had on Tuesday. But that's there are certain things the Torah felt it couldn't get rid of, so it allowed. Anyways, Marben Hashim, Marbek Shafim, Marbek Shrakot, Marbek Zima. You have a lot of people running around your house, servants, slaves, whatever you want to call them. There is possibility of inappropriate behavior, and there's also great possibility of people stealing things. It's just have to be very, very careful. What can I say? That's what the mission says. In other words, the things we pray for, right? So it doesn't always work now. So. But then the Mishnah continues, by the way, he explains, I say, going through life, the things you want. So you have the food, the money, the lust, and then honor. It's a big honor. A person has a whole entourage, you know, 8 slaves working for him. That's a very big big thing. So that's also the notion of kavod. And then the Torah has sort of the Mishnah, the rejoinder. So what do we do instead? Marbe Torah. If you have a lot of Torah, marbe chaim. This also is going through the cycle of life. We don't think of it like this. When you're young, Torah education, educating the youth, that's the most important idea. That's where it starts. Marbe Torah, marbe yeshiva. Marbe yeshiva is already a little bit of a higher sense. That's already your a little bit older. You should say you want to get wisdom. You have to get a basic education, then you want to get greater wisdom. Marbe Eitza. Marbe Eitza is now you can start giving people advice. Marbe Tuna, wisdom. Marbe Tztaka. You give Tztaka, Marbe Shalom. The lust for money is cured by giving away our money. Marbe Tztaka, and of course, you know, Tztaka is the method or the means for peace. To bring peace in the world, we give it through tzedakah. And of course, we know that tzedakah doesn't only mean money. Tzedakah is righteousness. But in the context here, it's meanings, because it's the first half is talking about our love of money. So here it's talking about give that money away. Train yourself to give that away. And that will give the world, bring more peace to the world. I just literally, like 5 minutes before I came on this morning, I had the radio on in my room, and there was, on the 9 o'clock news, and they were talking about research. I mean, this is obvious, but it's just interesting. That's on today's news, talking, they're starting to do research. You know, there, a lot of people are friendlier now. You know, when people go through, they have to, whatever the word is, they throw through a challenge, a crisis together. We're all in the same boat. So we, you know, you pass each other in the street. So, you know, you sort of, we separate from each other and we wave and we say hello to be nice. We smile at people. It's very nice. So it was talking, there's a lot of extra kindness, Baruch Hashem, going on in the world now. And then they said, research shows that when you do acts of kindness, people feel good about themselves. It brings them to, you know, all the goodness of the utilitarian argument for doing, you know, chesed, it makes you feel good. Anybody who's read anything about people who give money, they've done books. You know, they interview people who give away a lot of money. They'll tell you they feel the best when they write a check for $1 million. It's such a great feeling. And they feel not everybody has this, obviously, but they feel great when you marbet tzedakah, you're marbet shalom among the world, but you're also marbet internal peace, the shalom internally, by knowing that otherwise it's just like, who needs it all? Like, what are you going to do? Like, once you reach a certain point, like, you know, what else are you going to do with your blessings? And kana shem tov. And then the ultimate of this, if you live a life of this, of Torah and yeshiva and etzah and staka, then you acquire a good name. And we know from later on in Pirkei Avot that the greatest crown is the crown of a good name. There's the crown of Torah, but the crown of Torah, and there's the crown of royalty, and there's the crown of the priesthood, right? But a Kron Keter Shem Tov Ole Al Gabeyam. Oh, and Kanala Atzmo. It's very interesting. Only you can acquire a good name for yourself. When you acquire a good name, it becomes who you are. Kanala Atzmo, Kanalo Divrei Torah, Kanalo Olam Haba. Someone who acquires the ways of Torah, that's the pathways to the world to come. Okay, I want to move on to the next Mishnah. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. Mishnah Chet, at least in my cycle. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai Kibel Mehillah V'Shamay. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai took the mantle of Torah leadership from Hillel and Shammai. So we mentioned the first class we gave many weeks ago, that Pirkei Avot is a listing, it's a historical transmission of our Masorah, of our tradition. From Moshe Kibbutz Tor Misinai, Yeshua is Kain in the Beam, to Anshei Knesset Hagdola, the first part's all in Tanakh, we don't have to mention it. Anshei Knesset Hagdola, beginning of the Second Temple period, Ezra, and then Shimon HaTzadik was the end of the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, Antioch Nisocho, then the five Zugot, the five pairs of leaders, ending with Hillel and Shammai, and then we went to Rabban Gamliel, the Nisim, Rabban Gamliel, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, we skipped Rabban Gamliel the Yavne, up to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. That was a patriarchal system, who were the official leaders of the Jewish people. But now we're going to go back to the Torah. There's a second path from Hillel. In other words, one was the political, if you want to call it. Rabban Gamliel is the Nasi. The Nasi was a political position, really. He was the leader of it was a very important position. It was more powerful than the Beitinus. It was more powerful than the religious position, but it was more the communal leader, Rabban Gamliel and Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, etc. And then you had the learning leader, so to speak, or the transmission that went from Hillel to Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. So, we went back to Hillel, and now his student was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. Now, we mentioned the Gemara says, and obviously these are round numbers for purpose, that Hillel had 120 students. That's probably not a rounded number. Hillel had 120 students, and who the worst student of Hillel was, the Gemara says? Anybody want to guess? The Gemara says the worst student, was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. He was the weakest of the students. The Gemara says, I don't have it in front of me, the Gemara says Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, intellectually, and then the Gemara says he knew, I'm paraphrasing, he knew Bavli, Yerushalmi, Sifra, Sifri, Chumash. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai knew everything. But, still, he couldn't compare to Rav Yonatan ben Uziel. The Gemara has this funny expression. When Rav Yonatan ben Uziel would learn, if a bird flew overhead, it would get burned up. The fire of Torah, the excitement, wow, Rav Yonatan ben Uziel was unbelievable. A bird would get burned, whatever that means. He was the greatest. But, of course, we've mentioned this before, leadership is not who gets the 104 out of 100. You can get a 97 and be the leader too. The greatest rabbi is not the one who knows the most. It's the one who knows how to apply his knowledge as an understanding of the world. So it's very instructive. And when the Gemara is telling us that Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was quote unquote the weakest student of Hillel, so that's a powerful statement. It's not telling us to tell us that he was the weakest student. It tells us the weakest student can become the leader, the greatest leader. And it's relative. By the way, the halacha is, the Chafetz Chaim, I believe, quotes this halacha in Lashon Hara. It's not Lashon Hara to say that, this rabbi is a greater rabbi than that rabbi. You're saying this rabbi is not. It's not Lashon Hara. You're saying this rabbi is no more than that rabbi. Why is that Lashon Hara? But anyway, So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, Kibbel Mehillah v'Shammai, and I always like to quote with Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Gemara in Brachot says, what his great quality was? That lo hikdimo adam shalom b'shuk. Nobody said hello to him first. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, in other words, his great quality was he was the first one to say hello. Afilu Nachri, even idolaters. In other words, he would always say, and I always like to quote the story, I don't know if I've quoted it here recently, they have on Rav Yaakov, I think this is one of the Archro books, on Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky in his later life, so I've spoken about him a little bit. I saw how my grandmother used to like him so much when he was a rabbi in Toronto. She didn't really know who he was. but she knew how friendly he was. And compared to the previous rabbi who wasn't so friendly, when my grandmother, we're talking the late 1930s, when my grandmother was a young mother, and she would go ask her shaylos on the chicken, you know, that's the way it used to be, to Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky would say, Mrs. Friedman, how are you doing today? Et cetera. He's very, very friendly and schmooze with her. But anyways, when Rav Yaakov moved to Muncie in his later years, so they have the story that there, he lived near a monastery. And he would, I think, or what's for women, where all the nuns live. The monastery is for men only.
Nunnery.
Okay, thank you. So he would pass every day, he'd see nuns on the street, and he would always say, hello, how are you?
Convent.
Of course, none of the other yeshiva talk to a nun. How can you do that? They don't even talk to any of the Jewish girls. I can talk to the non-Jewish girls, you know. So talk to the nuns. And after he died, they came to pay a shiva visit, some of these nuns. And they said, you know, he was the only one who would say hello to us. All the other students, when they passed by, they never said hello. But this old man, you know, Rabbi Kamenetsky, he was the one. So that's what they say, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. His great quality was, nobody said hello to him first. Yes, he knew everything. He learned all the time, but you say hello to people. And we know that's not always easy to do. We know how hard that is. Anyways, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, as everybody knows, I think, but I'll just maybe point out a few things. He was the person who saved Judaism. We would not be here if not for Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He was the one who he saved. I don't want to talk politics, but he saved, according to the way the Talmud presents it, whether literal or not, and it's hard to believe it's 100% literal, but it doesn't matter. This is how the rabbis are understanding. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai saved Judaism by giving up Jerusalem. He said, you know, the Romans, the famous story, Vespasian said, I'll give you three things. And he didn't ask to not destroy the Beit HaMikdash. And the rabbis in Talmud are critical of him. What kind of an idiot he is? He could have brought sovereignty, could have annexed the Temple Mount. Why didn't he do that? So but he didn't do that. He didn't do that. He realized it was meaningless. It was useless. The Jewish people had so much moral deficiency, the sinat kinam, the hatred that the rabbis discussed, the non-getting along, that who cares, the Beit HaMikdash was a bunch of sticks and stones, and sticks and stones are not as important as human beings. So, tain li yavne v'chachameha, I mean, okay, I don't want to get, how it applies today, I'm not saying, but it is important to note that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did give up Yerushalayim when apparently he had a chance not to, because there are things more important. That's where Rav Soloveitchik, everybody knows, I don't know if everybody knows, but now you will, that Rav Soloveitchik famously said, to save one Jewish life, you give up Jerusalem. Now, that's a military question. Will giving up Jerusalem save any lives? Maybe it'll make it a lot worse. So maybe you have to annex the whole West Bank, because that's the only way to secure the Jewish people. But if it's going to be less secure, so you get back the West Bank. In other words, it's not a question of the holiness of the land. It's a question of the holiness of the people. And that's what Rav Soloveitchik said. And of course, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Rav Amital. This is a voice that today is less popular. You know, the religious Zionist world has moved very much to the right, the sort of more moderate left, you know, whatever you want to call it, is silenced a little bit more. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai clearly was part of that moderate left, whatever you want to call it, at least at that time. And Tein li yavneh b'chachamah, that saved Judaism. They recreated Judaism, and the Mishnah comes a little bit after that. I will say also some of the famous things we do, you know, we have we're coming up to the 3 weeks. So what do we do in the 3 weeks? So in the 3 weeks, we, especially in the 9 days, we have this notion of Zecher L'Churban, Zecher L'Mikdash. So it's really Zecher L'Churban. Zecher L'Churban is, you break a glass at a wedding, and you put ashes on the head, and we don't eat meat for the 9 days, and don't drink wine. And on Tisha B'Av itself, of course, we sit on the floor, and we say Kino. So that's Zecher L'Churban. We have to remind ourselves of the destruction of the temple. So that's what we have to do. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did something else, and people don't always realize there is an idea. We have to remember the Churban, but you also have to do Zecher L'Mikdash. We have to remember the glory of the temple. We don't have a temple. You know, we don't need a temple. We'll create our own temple. So what did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai do? He says, you know what? We're going to take the lulav for 7 days. You know, according to the Torah, you only take the lulav for 1 day, except in the temple. The temple of the Lula was taken off 7 days. So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said, we're in the new temple. We don't have the old temple. It's okay. Jewish life can survive without the temple. We make our temple here. So everybody takes the Lula for 7 days. You know what? In the time of the Beit HaMikdash, they blew shofar when Rosh Hashanah fell on Shabbos in the Beit HaMikdash. This year Rosh Hashanah is going to be on Shabbos, don't blow shofar. But in the temple, they blew shofar. So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai made a takana, made a decree, not only in Jews, any place where there's a court. So we don't have a Sanhedrin, that's okay. We've got our court here, and our court is good enough, we're going to blow the shofar. And then he had this amazing halakha, which it's a little bit, so complex. Yom hanef kulo asur. You know, chadash yashan, the whole thing of new flour. So you're not allowed to eat new flour that from last year, maybe, whatever, however it applies in modern times. You're not allowed to eat it, that's for sure. The maybe is that we have to worry about it, that we're eating last year's flour. They have to be makbi. Throughout history, Jews were not careful about this. The greatest of rabbis assumed it was not an issue to worry about. In recent years, you walk in, all the bakers today are yashan, they do worry about it. Okay, whatever. So the halacha was you could eat from the new grain as soon as they brought the korban ha'omer, that's the spirit omer, the korban omer on the second day of Pesach. They bring it at 8 o'clock in the morning. So whatever, 10 o'clock, 8 o'clock, you could eat the new wheat. So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai made a decree, you can't eat the chadash till a day later. Why? Because maybe next year they're going to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. See, really, you could eat it at the crack of dawn. No, but next year people are going to not realize that last year they could eat it at the crack of dawn because there was no temple. This year they have to wait till 10 o'clock till they bring the sacrifices. So somebody's going to make a mistake. He's going to eat new wheat. It's for breakfast at 7 o'clock in the morning. Remember, it's Pesach. So he's got to make the new wheat into matzah. He can't make it into bread, right? So he's going to eat this new wheat and we're afraid the temple was rebuilt and he doesn't know the law. And he goes, what kind of craziness is that? What's Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai doing? Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying the importance of the temple. We have to remember the temple, but in a positive light. So that was also something that we don't just mourn the loss of the temple. We move on and we make our own temple. We have a Mikdash Ma'at. We build our own shuls. Our home becomes a temple. That's why we pour salt whenever we eat bread, because in the temple, whenever they brought a sacrifice, they poured salt. So we're in our own temple at home. That's why we wash our hands, like the Kohanim washed their hands before they went in. We're just recreating the temple. That was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai's, you know, brilliance. It's easy to mourn the past, but what you have to do is take the past and recreate it in the future, even though we can't have it as originally wanted. So that was the genius of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, not just to mourn, to move on. That's the genius of the Jewish people. Again, that's the Jewish people after the Holocaust, what we created is unbelievable. We could be wallowing in our, the world owes us everything and they killed us and the world doesn't care, but that's not what we did. We move on, we build on. So that stems in many ways from Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. Okay. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, the quote-unquote the weakest student, but he was the greatest leader. He was the great leader. He saved Judaism. So he had the tradition from Hillel and Shammai. Hu hayomer, im lamadata Torah harbe. If you learned a lot of Torah, great guy. Nothing, no big deal. Al tachzek tova latzmacha. Don't think it's so good for you. Ki lekach notzarta. That's why you were created. You were created to learn. Don't think you're such a knucker because you learned for 10 hours a day. And you said, oh, yeah, and yeah. You know, often we've discussed that many times. Torah scholars have this fear of arrogance. The Netziv, all the commentaries say, because he learned Torah, I know more than you. I look down upon you, etc. So the rabbis were always very much afraid of that. So that's what Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying. Don't think you're so great. Ki lekach notzarta. That's why you were created. Now, it's very important. Ki lekach notzarta doesn't mean everybody. It means you. That's why you were created. Everybody has a role in this world, right? The doctor, that's a subspecialty, so he knows about the one little thing, but that's his role in the world, So everybody has a different role in the world. The Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying, don't think you were only created to learn Torah. Of course, everybody has to learn a little bit of Torah. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying, for the person who sits and learns, who whatever, he becomes a Torah scholar, okay. That's your job. Somebody else's job is to become a doctor. He'll probably do more good in the world than you learning Torah, most likely, on a practical level. Maybe some, the greatest Torah scholars, but the average person, someone else will become an artist and somebody else will become an engineer and somebody will do a very important job, become a social worker and a psychologist. Those are very important things. So everybody has a purpose for which they were created. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is not saying everybody's created only for the purpose of learning Torah. He says, you who think you're so great because you know you went through Daf Yomi 5 times and you know the Talmud inside out and you've got a brilliant mind and you were come from a wealthy family and your parents and your in-laws, whoever supported you for 15 years in Kollel, so you could know so much and give it Daf Yomi, so you're great. It's not great. That's your purpose in life. And somebody else has a different purpose in life. So that's where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai starts. Lamadata harbei Torah, it's beautiful, but that's your particular tafkid. And everybody else has their own purpose. Okay. Chamisha talmidim ayu lo l'Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had 5 students. Elohim, Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, Rabbi Yossi Yochanan, Rabbi Shimon ben Tana, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. So we are obviously not going to finish the whole Mishnah today, but please God, we'll continue next week. But okay, so let's just a few points here. Actually, before I get to there, does everybody here, I know this, and you can't ask a question like this, but I'll do it anyways for my own good. People know the story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and his students on his deathbed?
No.
No, you don't know the story. Okay, I'll very quickly tell the story. Yes. It's a famous story. I shouldn't say that. The story in Masechet Brachot is when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was on his deathbed, his students came to visit him, and he was crying. And the students said, why are you crying? And he said, wait a minute, why is he crying? He's about to die. So that's not the answer, because the Gemara has a lot of rabbis who are about to die, and they weren't crying. Because death is part of life. That's God created us. Death is tragic, but it's the our transition to the world to come. It's what how God created this world, and in the proper time, we need death, right? Rav Meir's famous comment, "Hinei tov ma'od, tov ha'mavet." It actually says in his Sefer Torah, it didn't say tov ma'od, it said tov mavet, right? Mem tav, right? Ma'od, the aleph and the vav, mavet. Death is very good. That's how the Medrash, a powerful Medrash. God saw the world, because the world, if there was no death, this world would be an awful place. Can you imagine if the Rambam was still alive? Who could be a Rosh Hashiva? Who could be a Da? Like, can you imagine? Like, people have to die. So give them new blood, new energy, new thing. Yeah. That's it's sad for the individual, the family, but it's great for the world. So the rabbis understood that. The rabbis didn't cry on their deathbed. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was crying on his deathbed. He said, what do you mean, why am I crying? If I would go before a king of flesh, of blood, who's here today and God tomorrow, and I can bribe him, and he's a lowlife and corrupt, and I can, give up, I'd be nervous. It's still pretty nerve-wracking. Now I'm going for the king of kings. Look, there's no shochet, you can't bribe, and everything, I shouldn't cry. So, of course, I'm crying. So, Rav Soloveitchik, in a beautiful explanation along the lines of what I just said, explains why was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai crying more than the other rabbis? He said, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made the fateful decision in Jewish history. He gave up Jerusalem. He let the temple be destroyed. He told the Romans, it's okay, destroy the temple, just give us Yavne. So I said how great that was. It was a great decision. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was tormented his whole life. Such a beautiful, the Rav had such a great insight. Now Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was tormented. Maybe he gave up Jerusalem and there are two paths. The Gemara said there are two paths, and I don't know which path they're taking me. I don't know which, should I fight or should I give up? So he was crying. A powerful story. And then the Gemara continues. His students were the 5 great students, Rabbi Elazar Gadol, who we just mentioned, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Elazar Ben Ar, the two most famous are Rabbi Eliezer Gadol and Rabbi Yeshua. But so they said, Rabbi, give us some final charge on our... what's your parting message for this world? So he says, okay, my dear students, you should fear God as much as man. And the students said, Rabbi, I learned that in kindergarten. I don't need you to tell me that. Rabbi, tell us like a Rav Chaim, tell us a great Torah insight. Tell us some, I don't need that to fear God. What kind of silliness? I don't need you to tell me this. I'm paraphrasing, as I'm sure you realize. And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said, Halavai, that I'm not paraphrasing. Halavai, if only. When a person sins, what does he say? Is anybody watching? Is anybody going to catch me? Halavai, that we should fear God as much as we fear other human beings. How much we fear other And this is unbelievable. He's talking to his five greatest students. He's talking to the great, we mentioned fear of God. It's really hard. We spoke about that last week. Yireh Elohim. It's hard to fear God. We can talk about it. It's easy. It's not easy. It's really, really, really hard. So of course we're more afraid of man. So that was the parting message of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai on his deathbed. Fear God as much as you fear man. That's great. Then you're doing really, really great. And of course, the most important thing, it is the simple things in life that are most important. So anyways, that's those stories that go together. He was dying and he was crying, and the Gemara doesn't say he was crying because of that decision. Rav Soloveitchik explained the reason he was crying because he had made this faithful, and that's true about life. When you make important decisions, you never know. We've mentioned it a few times. That's why leaders are only allowed to become leaders if they work lishma, oskim besarche, right? No, most people can do Torah mitzvah for the wrong reasons. Who cares? You do the right thing. But when you're a leader, you have to do it for the right reason, because everything a leader does impacts on somebody in a bad way. Whatever great decision you make, somebody's going to be hurt. It's impossible to make decisions for a community that don't hurt people. So you better be properly motivated. So we want a leader who's going to cry and who can't sleep at night. I mean, it's not a nice thing to say, but when Rav Elazar ben Azariah gets appointed leader, he turns gray overnight, right? The famous story, Harayani Kiven Shivim Shana. Because you lead, you should turn gray overnight, because if you're not turning gray overnight, it means you're not worried enough about the people. I mean, leader, what is it? It's a joke. I'm going to run for office, you know? So that's now you know why Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is the weakest student, so to speak. He wasn't such a weak student, but you know, the Gemara emphasized he was the lowest of the 120 students. No birds burned when they flew over his head. So yet he's the great, great leader, the great insight of the Jewish people, but he didn't know. It takes hundreds of years sometimes to know if your decisions are right. So that's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So let's discuss now just a little bit Rav Elazar. So his five students, Rav Elazar ben Hyrcanus, Rav Elazar HaGadol. So I don't know if people know the story of Rav Elazar HaGadol. It's funny. His name is Rav Elazar ben Hyrcanus. Why? Because his father's name was Hyrcanus, right? So his name was, who was Hyrcanus? Hyrcanus was a wealthy businessman. It's a wealthy, they owned a lot of real estate. That's what Gemara said. They owned, you know, estates. And he was expected to work in the family business. He, at the age of 22, this is in, I think, Avot the Rabbi Natan is the main source. The age of 22, he had enough of this. He wants to learn Torah, but he knew nothing. He's like Rabbi Akiva. But, you know, the gap between the knowledgeable and the non-knowledgeable was supreme. Like, it's not like today. Today, there's a much more narrowing of the gap. The elite aren't as elite as they used to be. And the ignorant aren't as ignorant as they used to be, right? Everybody who wants to more or less get someone, everybody knows how to read, most kids in our community spend a year in Israel in yeshiva. I mean, like, you know, the level is way higher than ever in Jewish history. And our leadership is not so amazing as it was at one time. There's a narrowing of the gap. But in the time of the Gemara, you know, you had from the people who the birds burned when they flew overhead, and people who couldn't read Aleph Beit. Very little in the middle. So Rav Elazar ben Hyrcanus basically couldn't read Aleph Beit. So the Gemara says at 22, he runs to Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. His father cuts him off. What kind of idiot? Where are you going to yeshiva? That's it. Family business, not for you. You're not getting any money. You're not supporting you. You're Narishkeit. So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai had to support him. And he said, the Medrash says that he had to teach him Kiddush. He had to teach him Aleph Beit. He basically knew nothing. What did Gemara say? Kriyat Shema Tfilat Birchan Amazon. He didn't know how to say Shema. He's 22 years old. Doesn't know how to say Shema. Doesn't know how to daven. Doesn't know how to say Birchan Amazon after the meal. So that's Rav Yochanan. That's how the Medrash presents it. And then his father was going to, the brothers who were all working on the farm, the brother said to the father, you know, you got this, our idiot brother there. Why, you're making your will. So cut him off. Don't give him a penny. You know, don't give him a penny. So the father, to his credit, said, you know what, before I cut my son off, I'm going to cut him off, but let me go visit him. So he goes to visit him, and he comes to the Beis Medrash, and Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai gets wind that he's coming. So he has Rav Elazar ben Hyrcanus, he asked him to give the shiur that day, and he blew everybody away. The rabbis were like blown away. The Gemara says they heard things like they never heard from Sinai. It was so powerful. They didn't know whether it was day or light outside. They didn't know. You know, they're so enthralled this year. Rav Schachter told us once that, you know, anybody who had the privilege to hear Rabbi Soloveitchik, I don't know if anybody here ever heard Rabbi Soloveitchik speak in live in person. You know, Rabbi Soloveitchik was a mesmerizing, you know, speaker, unbelievable orator, unbelievable. He literally would speak for 4 or 5 hours and nobody would move. He would give his Shabbat Shuvah, Drasha. He would talk 2 hours Halacha, 2 hours Agada. I mean, he was mesmerizing. And people said that Rav Schachter told us once that he was so powerful, Rav Soloveitchik could convince you in July that it was snowing outside. In other words, he had this, I just thought of that when they said the Medjed, they didn't know if it was day or night inside. They were so moved by the shiur. Sort of the opposite of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Moshe Rabbeinu was a lousy speaker. He spoke last week, but both are important, right? We don't want somebody observing Torah because a great orator convinced him. So we have that idea of Moshe. But great oratorical skills are a wonderful thing to have. They really do help, and it presents Torah in a modern way and in relevance, and it inspires people. So the speech blew people away. That's what it says, Kenitinami Sinai. They were greater than they were given at Har Sinai. So the father was so moved that the father says, I'm giving you the entire inheritance. I'm going to disinherit the brothers. And you're like, unbelievable. You know, we have a farmer. What's this, all this money for? I'm giving it to you. And the son said, I don't need the money. I just want to sit and learn Torah. That's how the Abbot Rabbi Natan presents Rav Elazar ben Hyrcanus. Again, how much of this is actually rooted 100% in history? I don't know. I think anybody knows it. That it doesn't matter, in a sense, right? But that's, and then he becomes Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol. Now, I'll end by one idea. Maybe I'll begin with the question, maybe, so I'll do what the Gemara recommends, that when you depart from a friend, you should leave him with the question so they think about you, right? Please, maybe I'll do that. You can think of the answer. Maybe not. So that's one Gemara. That's in the Abba to Rabbi Natan. The Gemara in Sukkah, that same Gemara that says Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was the weakest of the students of Hillel and he learned all of Torah, that same Gemara, a few lines apart, says that Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol lo amar davar shelo shema mipi rabo. He never said anything that he didn't hear from his teacher. And the Gemara says they asked him 30 questions and he said 18, there's a debate, 12 or 18. 12 or 18, I heard from my teacher, here's the answer. The other, I didn't hear, I only repeat. I'm just a cog in the mechanism of transmitting Torah. From who am I? I'm a nobody, I don't teach. So the question is, my favorite subject, how we began, contradictions, right? These two statements seem to blatantly contradict each other. Whereas he's the super original, thinker, the words that we didn't even hear from Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai, we didn't know if it was night or day, or was he this very boring person who just repeated what his Rebbe said, and he wouldn't say anything original. So that's the Gemara, these two ideas of presented Rabbi Lezer. So maybe, I don't know if I'll say it. So next week we'll begin with the answer Rav Cook gives, how to reconcile these two, that they're not in contradiction to each other. He can say everything that's exactly from his Rebbe, and yet at the same time, it can be totally original, like from the days of Sinai. Okay, just let me very quickly review what we discussed. We had Hillel speaking in Aramaic, and the problem, the contradiction, Hillel here saying life is fair, you do something to somebody, you'll get punished, and that person will then get punished again. And on the other hand, we have Tzaddik V'Ra'lo Rosh HaVatovlo, the question that Moshe Rabbeinu asked, Eov asked, all the medieval philosophers asked, and of course there's no real answer, there are approaches, ideas, but we have to live with the tension of these two ideas. Sometimes life is mida negen mida, sometimes it's not. Then we discuss things we want. We all want money and food and wealth and lust and honor. But if you get too much of it, you use it properly, it's not good. The worms and the worry and the stealing, it isn't worth it. But if you have a life of Torah and yeshiva and ultimately leading to kind of shame to have, the ultimate goal is to acquire yourself a good name. Moved on to Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, discuss how he saved Judaism. Great learning, of course, is important. He says that's why we were created. Some people, most people were not created for that purpose. He was created for that purpose, but even so, he was, quote unquote, the weakest student of Hillel, but obviously he's still a great student, but more importantly, a great leader. The foresight, to know at great personal pain. He really was tormented his whole life, but the decision to give up on Yerushalayim, to create Judaism anew at Yavne, that saved Judaism, to recreate the temple, not just to mourn the temple, but to take the simcha of the temple and recreate it in our own lives. Book, and then we're moving on, and then we'll pick up next week with the students. We just introduced Rabbi Lezer Ben Hurkanis. Now I see there, I think, okay, so a couple questions on things. This is about individual or nations, Rome, not to directly anger them. In other words, I'm not 100% sure I understand the question, but yes, God, idea what he told the Egyptians to punish the Jews, or he told the, so we're going to be servants, but the Egyptians didn't have to do it. No individual, that's how some talk about it. No individual Egyptian had to enslave us, or they didn't have enslaved us the way they did, but it works. It's true about nations and about people. The Gemara in the beginning of Avodah Zarah talks about how nations will come to God and say, the Greeks come and say, look what we did for the Jews. The Romans will come. We built all these things for the Jews. We built pathways and we created marketplaces. And there's a whole discussion between God and the nations of the world. And God said, is that what you did? That's what you wanted for us. So there is an idea, yes, that not only are individual judged, but nations are also judged. The Sinat Chinam can be a statement that we can't explain the theodicy. That, yeah, we can't explain. Right, the Sinat Chinam is the rabbis looking internally. Of course, but in a certain sense, they're justifying, right? It's the theodicy that we did something wrong. In other words, normally it's presented, we justify God. The Jewish people were so much fighting, we deserved the punishment. But I don't think that's what it's about. It's really about, we don't know, God had his plans, whatever, their historical factors. What message, I have discussed many times, we don't ask Lama. That was Rav Soloveitchik. It's also beautiful. Remember, there are no nikudot anywhere in our text, in our real text. It's not Lama, it's Lama. For what, when we say on the keynote, Lama lenetzach, it's Lama, really. For what can we gain from what happened? We don't know what happened. We can't understand God's ways, but we can learn from them. Okay, Rabbi, can we eat chicken or turkey? Say turkey with cheese, turkey with milk. It's not a cow, not a cheese. Yes, according to the Torah, of course, you can eat. But, of course, we don't follow just the Torah. We follow the rabbis. Rav Yossi at Galili, in his town, they ate chicken and milk because that was the tradition that he felt. The rabbis forbade it because they were afraid you'd mix up chicken and meat. But if not... at that time, Rav Yosef Lee wasn't afraid, and they were allowed. And the Talmud praises the people for eating chicken and milk. I don't want to say unfortunately, whatever, but we today, that doesn't work. I mentioned last week, I think, once the Talmud was closed, we don't have the authority to argue on what became accepted Talmudic norms, and that became accepted around the world, that we can't eat chicken and milk. When we build the Sanhedrin, if they get a Sanhedrin back, maybe Bimeir or Bimeinu, maybe they can undo that. Okay, temple was rebuilt. Somebody privately, the Chadash won't continue. No, it should continue. The law of the new wheat, that's a specific really temple. Thing. It applies everywhere, but it was thought you brought the Korban HaOmer. That's what the Sfiras HaOmer was. You counted from the Korban HaOmer. That was an important time. That was marking that God is the master of our harvest. It was the beginning of the harvest season. The barley was the first grain to harvest in Israel, talking late March, early April. And so the Korban HaOmer was an important thing. That's why there was such a battle with the Sadducees, right, when it was going to be. Obviously, today we can't relate to it, but the Omer, we just have counting the Omer, but the counting was the minimal, it was the bringing of the Omer. The Omer just means a measure of barley. Okay, so I want to wish everybody a wonderful Shabbat, to be healthy and well, please God that we should get a reversal, you know, the spiking up in the cases. Let's hope people, whatever, adhere to the restrictions and the whatever, we find cures and we should hear good news, right? It's not so much how many cases, it's how severe they are. So let's hope that even though there's been a huge rise in the cases, it won't lead to huge rise in the death rate. It hasn't happened yet, but have to wait and see. Okay, everybody be well, be healthy. Shabbat Shalom. Monday morning, of course, we start with our 24 books on Tanakh. I really think I'm very proud of this series, if I can say so. We put together 24, I think, really top-notch people. 75 minutes, we'll do an hour lecture, 10, 15-minute questions. That's how I sort of instructed all the teachers. And then starting Bereshit on Monday, continuing Shemot Tuesday, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday for the next 8 weeks. Okay, thank you, everybody. Shabbat Shalom. Be well. Bye-bye.